Thanks, Perry. And as Perry said, my name's John Kierkegaard. I'm a farming systems agronomist based in Canberra in Australia. Following somewhat the theme of the previous two speakers, I'll give you a little bit of background, first of all to Australian farming systems, which some of you may not be so familiar with, and then a little bit of a history of how both intensification of cropping and diversification of cropping has occurred in Australia. Finish off with some of the current issues and challenges we have within that, and some of the research that we're doing to deal with that. So there's sort of three phases of evolution that I want to discuss, and some of the issues that occurred in each one. And then, as I said, I'll finish off with some work on crop-seeking triggers, which is an area we're working on now, trying to understand what might trigger a farmer to switch from a continuous cereal like wheat to use a break crop, as we call them. So just some background to Australian farming systems. Basically, it's almost entirely dry land. There's very little irrigated grain cropping in Australia. It's almost all dry land, and it's in that yellow band, which we call the wheat belt, which is sort of 300 to 500 mil or 12 to 20 inch rainfall. Now, we're really strange in Australia. We grow one spring crop per year in our winter. Our crops don't go under snow. We have cool but not very cold winters. So we grow a spring crop sown in the autumn or fall, which is April or May, and harvested in early summer. Mean wheat yields are about 2 to 3 tonnes per hectare across the whole area. You can see the rainfall varies from being summer dominant in the northeast of the country to being equi-seasonal in the southeast, and then quite Mediterranean as you move into Western Australia. Very dry summers and very wet winters. The soils are almost invariably infertile. They're very old and weathered soils. If you think of a problem with soils, you'll find it in Australia. Acidity, salinity, compaction, all in the main sort of crop growing areas. We have some pockets of good soils, but they're fairly small. That limits in some cases the choice of crops we can grow because of different soil types that we're dealing with. And the agriculture comparatively is unsubsidised, so it's risky. The rainfall is not just low, it's quite variable. This is a typical kind of annual rainfall records for a site in the wheat belt in Victoria. And just to notice that from year to year, the rainfall is very unpredictable, as well as the average being quite low. And the red line just shows what's happened in the period we call the millennium drought, this trend that we're seeing in Australia towards lower rainfall, and particularly quite variable spring rainfall. So I want to, I guess the background of my talk covers three phases, and I've put them against this map of national wheat yields in Australia, just to sort of, so I can talk or frame each one, I guess. I'm not going to go back pre-war, but basically post-World War II, essentially in that period we adopted a lay farming system where cereal crops were grown on mixed farms, rotated with periods of clover-based pastures. So the sheep were on the clover-based pastures. We would grow those for 4 or 5 years, and then we would plough that up and seed cereals, mostly wheat or barley, in that period. Around the beginning or mid-1980s, beginning of the 1990s, basically driven by low wool prices, crops started to intensify. Conservation agriculture, no-till, was developed and adopted, and that's when diversification of cropping started happening in this sort of period here, particularly in the decade of the 90s. And then in 2002, this period we now call the Millennium Drought happened, where we had that 10-year period of below average rainfalls across the whole country, basically, which we've emerged from in 2010. You can see we're back up to record yields for wheat again now. But that 10-year period was sufficiently long to generate a real change and some real issues in our farming system, which I'll go into. So just, again, this first phase, the pasture lay phase, up until that time you saw we were in a wheat fallow system similar to what was described earlier. And during this period, farmers adopted this system of mixed farming with sheep for wool, rotated with cereals, mostly wheat or barley. That pasture phase could be 3, 4, 5 years. It was mostly self-regenerating annuals like subterranean clover or medix that would be then ploughed up, and we would grow wheat or barley for 2 years until the nitrogen was exhausted, and then fertility would be restored by going back to pasture. So essentially what was happening in that system was we were maintaining soil fertility. The soil fertility was building under the pasture phase quite quickly. It was eroded pretty rapidly under the cropping phase, but then you'd rotate back to pasture. And basically the soil was staying in this kind of limit of organic matter where we didn't crash out and start damaging soil structure by having lengthy cropping phases. So that was pretty stable. It was economically, the farmers had these two income streams from crops and from wool. Wool prices were high. It was a pretty good system, both biologically, economically, and it still, I guess, underpins most of the cropping system in Australia. The general principle underpins it, but some things have changed since that period. What happened was that wool prices started to decline, and farmers started to move out of sheep to lengthen the cropping phase, to shorten the pasture phase. And so over this period since 1990, you can see a very big reduction in sheep numbers. When I started working at CSIRO, there was 160 million sheep in the country, and now there's 72 million. So that's what's happened to the national sheep flock. And at the same time, grain production has increased from 15 million tonnes up to 48 million tonnes. Now, that doesn't signify necessarily it's not all coming from an increase in area. A lot of that's due to the increase in yield that you saw. But certainly, cropping has increased at the expense mostly. Cropping area has increased mostly at the expense of pasture in our mixed farming system. So as I said, during the 1990s, as farmers started to lengthen that cropping phase and reduce the pasture phase, there was a need to look for, because a lot of them had started to get out of sheep as an enterprise, they needed to look for other, to diversify the cereal system in order to control weeds, diseases and other things. And the first crop really that was grown on a widespread basis were lupins in Western Australia in particular. They came into the Western Australian system in the 1980s and became very well established as in a rotation there with wheat. Later on in the 1990s, it was canola in southeastern Australia and then ultimately in Western Australia. But several things happened during this period. Farms got larger, sort of again driven by the economics and the need for scale. The area of crop on the farm increased in this period by about 3.6% per annum. We had less pasture with fewer sheep, more crop diversity, and this was all, as we've heard previously, on the back of the adoption of no-till systems with stubble retention. Now, the adoption of those break crops in what were continuous cereals, essentially, rotated with grass based pastures, legume and grass based pastures. In those systems, there was a grass in the system all the time. It was either ryegrass or wheat or barley. So there were a huge number of grass diseases, soil-borne grass diseases like take-all, Rhizoctonia, Fusarium. They were just ubiquitous in the system. And farmers, when they saw wheat crops that had been grown after either a legume or canola, they were essentially wheat farmers, and they saw these wheat crops and really the break crops adopted themselves during that period, because you see this kind of early dye from take-all, that was the kind of crops that farmers were used to seeing, and they started seeing these incredibly healthy wheat crops and 30-40% higher yields. So initially, adoption of lupins in the west and canola in the east was quite rapid. And there was a lot of research done during this period to quantify the value of that, similar to the research we saw earlier from both North Dakota and Canada. Lots of work to show that indeed wheat yields were increased on average by 20% or 0.6, 0.7 of a tonne per hectare the first wheat crop after a break crop. Better control of weeds. If it was a legume, we estimated we were getting an equivalent benefit of about 20 to 50 kilograms of N per hectare. And these crops also facilitated that rapid adoption of no-till, because it was much easier to seed into a legume or a canola residue retained than it was a cereal residue. So the two things went hand in hand, and things were going along fine. Here's some data just showing that benefit. In this case, it's for lupin in Western Australia. A bit of a summary of about 30 years of data. So this is a graph of the yield of wheat after wheat compared to the yield of wheat after lupin for Western Australia. So the dotted line, the dashed line, is the one-to-one if you are getting the same yield. Anything above the line, the yield after lupin is higher. And so you can see it didn't take long for growers to recognise that they were getting much better yields after lupin. I think the average was about 0.8 of a tonne there. And by 1998, we were up to 12 million hectares of wheat, 2 million hectares of canola, and 1.5 million hectares of lupin. So, you know, nearly a quarter of the area was going into some form of break crop. And so if you took into account some of the wheat that was going in after pasture, there was quite a lot of the crop was being sown after some sort of break. When we looked into some of this longer term information, it was interesting to see that if you looked at the yield benefit for wheat growing after lupin compared to wheat growing after wheat, in the early days when lupins were first being grown, the yield benefit was about half a tonne per hectare to the following wheat crop in that sort of 1980s period. During that period, we probably weren't growing lupins very well. When we started to adopt no-till, we started to grow better lupin crops. We could seed them earlier. We got higher yields of lupins, better weed control. And the break crop benefit that flowed onto the following wheat crop almost doubled. So how well you grow the rotation crop also has an impact on the size of the value to the following wheat crop. And we also were measuring benefits flowing through to a third wheat crop. That benefit in the case of the legume break crops was not just in that first wheat crop. It was still persistent into a third continuous wheat crop sown after the lupin. So by 1998, as I said before, there was about 1.2 million hectares of lupin in Western Australia. But you can lose diversity as quickly as you can get it. This year in Australia, there's 0.25 million hectares of lupins. And basically what happened was herbicide resistance. Herbicide resistance in continual no-till cropping systems in Australia has essentially now drives what we do. Because most of the cheap grass selective herbicides in wheat are just no longer effective for ryegrass, which is the most difficult weed we have, and also some for wild radish. So it's now just too expensive. You can control them, but it costs a lot of money to control those weeds in lupin. So lupin just started to slide out of the system, mainly for that reason. Also because farmers, at the moment, the price for nitrogen fertiliser and fungicides, they've got other technologies that can help deal with those problems in the cereal that are currently cheap enough to make them attractive. We had a few low rainfall years and a whole lot of other factors. We've now slipped back to there being only a quarter of a million hectares of lupins in Western Australia. So it's just to show that, you know, even though we know it works well, the benefits are there, other things in the system change and you can lose that diversity. So partly to do with that, but moving on to the 2000s, when we hit this almost 10-year period of drought in Australia, you can sort of see this is just for one area in Victoria. Basically, when we go into dry seasons in Australia, the alternative crops become very risky. Canola and other grain legumes are very risky when you go into one of these phases of dry conditions, or at least that's farmers' perceptions. And so the cereal area in black, the wheat area starts to go up, and the break crop area drops. Farmers have also done other things during that period to deal with the drier conditions, and to maintain stubble, they've widened rows. That has other implications for weed control, all of these changes occurred in that 10-year period. And there's a lot of good reasons why growers do this. As I said, under dry conditions, cereals are easy to manage and market in Australia. They are lower risk. They're reliable. When things are very dry, they also leave a lot more residue. The farmers are aware that they need to keep residue on the soil. And cereals will provide more residue and more resistant residue. And there's a whole lot of new technologies that have come out in the last decade that allow growers to manage some of the things that we were relying on the break crops to manage previously. There's also DNA testing services now, so farmers can check soil before they sow a wheat crop and know how much root disease they've got there, whether it's risky or not. So they've got a few other technologies, inter-row sowing, so they can keep this year's crop away from last year's residue, and a lot of new herbicide options. So there's a few technologies that actually driving us back to it making sense to growers to intensify their cereals again. But one of the issues that, as I mentioned, is particularly herbicide-resistant ryegrass. That picture at the bottom just shows what it can be like for someone who ends up with a ryegrass population resistant to every herbicide, including Roundup. And there's the number of populations of annual ryegrass that have been identified in Australia that are resistant to glyphosate. And this also makes people cautious about wanting to use a Roundup ready crop, because they're already using Roundup as a really important fallow management tool in their no-till systems, and they're anxious about increasing the amount of Roundup because of that. And this now, as I said, this now pretty much dominates all the decision making around what their crop sequence, what their rotation is going to be. Just to give you some idea, I'm not sure whether you have the same herbicides with the same names, but at least you can see there the percentage of, so this is just people going out into paddocks, fields, and taking the ryegrass, getting the seed and checking to see whether it's resistant to a range of herbicides. And that's the percentage of fields that were found in those different places around Australia in those different years, resistant to a range of herbicides, so group A's, group B's, some Treflan, and I didn't add Simazine, and so triazine herbicides, and I just showed you Roundup. So you can get to a point where you run yourself out of options if you don't manage this. And so some of our recent work, partly driven by this issue, we're taking a sort of a new look at crop sequences and asking a few questions, particularly around this perception about profitability. Growers have this perception that the break crops are risky and not as profitable as cereals, particularly in dry conditions. So we're starting to look at lower risk and lower cost ways of keeping the break crops there. We understand the biological benefits of it, but the economics, you know, often are not stacking up. So we're looking for ways to grow both the break crop and also the cereal that are less risky and lower input. And we're also having a look to see how we can manage herbicide-resistant ryegrass and other weeds. That's become, as I said, the dominant thing that we need to manage now. So a lot of our crop sequence experiments will have canola is our main non-cereal break crop now. It's up to about 2.4 million hectares now in Australia. And there's a range of herbicide tolerance options. I think one thing most people don't know is that 80% of Australian canola is triazine tolerant. We can still use triazine herbicides in Australia. I think they're banned in the US, but 80% of our crops are triazine tolerant. So we can spray them with triazine herbicides to control weeds, and that's very attractive to farmers because it's very cheap and effective. Although now they have resistance to some of those herbicides. Roundup Ready has just come in recent years. It's not legal in all states. There's still two states in Australia which don't allow GM crops. The other four do. But Roundup Ready comes as a package of hybrids and it's reasonably expensive, so that's more of a high input option. And now there's RT canola, which is resistant to both Roundup and triazine. That's going to be available on the market this year. So these are all different options in the canola phase that we're checking. We've also kept grain legumes, either for grain or now brown manures, because the economics of this now has made growing a grain legume and spraying it out as a brown manure attractive, because you get weed control, nitrogen supply and water saving. And that's an option we're now looking at, which wouldn't have been economic 10 years ago. And then in the wheat phase, you can either look at a low input wheat or a high input wheat. You know, what farmers want to know is, can we buy our way out of a herbicide resistance problem by just throwing a lot of expensive herbicides at the wheat? So just a few recent results from experiments. This one here just shows if you're in a hot, reliable high rainfall site and you don't have herbicide resistant weeds, then you're sort of pretty crazy not to stick with a canola wheat rotation. The gross margin, the average gross margin over the 2 years is still very attractive, more so than lupin. And certainly you wouldn't consider a brown manure legume in a system like that. But the break crops go pretty well. And this, as I said, that's a high rainfall where the break crops are pretty reliable and you can... And it's in those areas they tend to be adopted quite well at a reasonable frequency in the rotation. In drier areas now, moving to a much drier area, you do have more trouble convincing growers that break crops can pay. But this recent work we've done here shows the gross margin over 4 years with just one break crop in a four-year rotation with three wheats after that. So this up here. And the break varied from different legumes, canola, mustard, fallow, used for either grain or for hay. And if you compare things on a sandy soil, that's a line that shows you the continuous wheat gross margin. There's a lot of things above that line. And if you're on a clay soil with slightly lower fallow efficiency, again, there's a lot of things above that line. So we are beginning to provide the data for growers that even in these dry areas, having a break in the system can pay. And the brown manure legumes here also pay, because generally you get a water benefit in the second year and you get a nitrogen benefit that will carry on for 2 to 3 years in that system. So even growing a legume and just spraying it out gives you a benefit over 4 years. Now, this is the more common situation. If you're in a place where you have developed a herbicide resistance problem, then the sort of game changes a little bit about what your options are. This shows a Roundup Ready canola, so a high input first year followed by wheat. Still a good gross margin, as I showed you, compared with these other options if you just look at that 2 year situation. But the question is, if in a few years we want to get back to having wheat that's free of these herbicide resistant weeds, then what sort of a sequence do we really need to be looking at to get on top of the weed seed bank so that we can get back to growing crops like that one? And is that Roundup Ready wheat system going to get us there? And here I'm just comparing a sort of a high input Roundup Ready wheat system with a brown manure, a lupin wheat system, which looks pretty awful in year, you know, in this first 2 years, you're going backwards. And if you look at where you end up in terms of cost of herbicide, the number of ryegrass panicles you have, you can see if you stick with wheat, you just end up with a disaster. If you use either the canola or the lupin, you can get the weed seed bank down to levels that are starting to get reasonable. The legume has given you a bit more nitrogen, as well as the weed control, the bran manure legumes giving you some nitrogen. But what I can show you is that, when we looked at how many ryegrass panicles we ended up with in that canola wheat system in the third year, we still ended up with 512 panicles per square metre of ryegrass. So what it's telling us is when you've got that much herbicide-resistant ryegrass in the seed bank, you're going to need a two-year break to get anywhere near getting on top of that issue. And as well as these experiments, so in order to look at this over any period of time, we need to bring in some models because of the limitations on experiments. And we have both crop simulation models and other models that we can use to try to put the information on all these different aspects of break crops together and see where we'll end up over a number of years by making some assumptions and using the data that we've got. And this kind of shows a whole range of different options. Four-year sequences, that's a continuous sequence with wheat and barley. This has got canola in 1 year. This has got field peas. This is a brown manure for 1 year. And these are two-year rotations, two-year breaks. So brown manure canola, and this is field pea canola. And just to show you where you end up with your your weed seed bank. If you stick with continual cereals, you're heading for a train wreck. And really, even a one-year break after about 6 to 8 years is not enough to keep these weed seeds, ryegrass at least, under control. So two-year breaks are now becoming a necessity. And you can put the dollars over all of this as well and just show that, you just go out backwards if you stick with continuous cereals. But this is all driven by weeds and herbicide-resistant weeds. So at the moment we're looking at trying to develop some crop sequence triggers, because the fact is in Australia that the economics still favour the tactical use of break crops in an otherwise cereal-dominated system. That's where they're driving us at the moment. We know we need them, but it's a matter of how often we need them. And what we'd like to do is to identify these trigger points where either a weed, a disease, or nitrogen, or price, something triggers the sensible use of one of these breaks in the system. And from that break, we then get a series of cereals, which have all those benefits which I told you. And a few examples of triggers might be the weed seed bank for ryegrass. We know the impact ryegrass has on wheat yields, so that may be a trigger. The trigger to swap to a legume from an oilseed might be the level of soil nitrate at sowing, because we know legumes will get lazy at fixing nitrogen when the soil nitrate at sowing is high. So you'd only go to a legume when the soil nitrate at sowing was sufficiently low. Most growers are testing this pre-sowing. It's something they're already doing. And finally, we have now soil DNA tests, pre-sowing soil DNA tests for most of the cereal root diseases, so the farmer can know before sowing a crop what the likely impact's going to be. So these are a few conclusions. As I said, in our system in Australia, at least, the economics are favouring this tactical use, I think, like the dynamic approach. But we need to know what's the trigger, and there's many triggers. Herbicide-resistant weeds for us are driving things now, and I hope you don't find yourself in the same circumstances, but ryegrass is a particular case, I think. And what we really need in Australia, I think, is a widely adapted high-value grain legume. We have grain legumes that suit small pockets. We had lupins. We've lost them. But that's the kind of crop we need again that can get up to 2 million, 3 million hectares, that's widely adapted and high value, so probably human food use. And if you look at what's happening, if you take the 10 years of drought out, you can see cereals are staying pretty stable. Canola is going up and we think can get to 3.5 million hectares. But essentially legumes have just stayed flat for the last decade, the total area of grain legumes. And pastures, because of the relative prices of sheep, and I hope pastures make a comeback, but unfortunately a lot of guys have sold the sheds, gotten rid of the troughs, taken the fences out. It's a long way back for some of those farmers. So that's all.